Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, October 20th, the Killing Off the Kings edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. And in the New York studios, we have June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine.
Hi, Hannah.
Hi.
It feels crazy that we were talking about Trump just 2 weeks ago. And as we were preparing, I was trying to figure out how much has happened since then.
Yeah, it's amazing how much is revealed on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and how many, like, women-y things happen in this election.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what's crazy. Like, it's become an election about gender in a weird way.
And yet, the fact that we probably are going to have the first woman president has almost been forgotten. Like, somebody mentioned that the other day. I was like, oh, yeah, right, that too, yeah.
Save it for the segment, Thomas.
All right. So our first segment, we are going to talk about Trump. Is Trump the ultimate gift to women, as some op-ed columnists had been suggesting this week? Second, we're going to talk about Insecure, the new HBO show about the brutal realities of dating, starring Issa Rae. We'll talk to Emily Witt about her new book, Future Sex. And, June, you want to talk about our Slate Plus segment this week?
Absolutely. In our Slate Plus segment this week, we'll discuss whether the Nobel Prizes are sexist. If you're not yet a Slate Plus member, you can start your free 2-week trial by visiting slate.com/xxplus.
So here's the question. This is how I thought of it. So many years from now, will you look back and think the 2016 election was finally the moment when people actually understood what sexual harassment means, what many women face on a daily basis, and we will have to turn around and say, thank you, Donald Trump, for that gift? That's how I was thinking about it. Just to fast forward, right? Like, we'll be like Saturday Night Live. We'll be like, can we just call you President Clinton already? Just like they do on SNL. And just like, just try and fast forward and think, what was this all about? So maybe we'll start with the Anita Hill comparison, which was very useful for me. Mm-hmm. Like, Noreen, you were like a child.
Yeah,
I condescend not that often to you on this podcast, but in this case, I'm allowed to. So I'm directing this question to June. Does this feel like the Anita Hill? Like, does it feel Anita Hill-ish to you?
It does remind me of the Anita Hill moment, especially because suddenly we're all absolutely gripped by one particular narrative in a very messy, very narrative-strewn campaign. I mean, one of the things that people have been saying about Trump, and I agree with, is that he gets away with stuff because every time, you know, one scandal that would have brought down any other candidate, he gets away with because he'll just throw out another scandal. And so instead of like dealing with one scandal and running it down, for him, there's like 230. And so, you know, nothing really takes a grip on the sort of the news because something's going to come along a second later. But this thing really has grit. And it clearly has triggered a lot of people. I mean, there's been so many stories, you know, on an unprecedented scale, as far as I'm concerned, saying that this guy's attitude and the way that he talks and the way that he has not taken responsibility has brought something up that I thought was, you know, not exactly tamped down, but that just that I had under control. And that is, there's clearly a very sort of public national moment that's going on. And I don't think that we're going to take 25 years to make sense of this. I think this is already happening. And I think it's kind of, you know, it's a, I don't know, a threshold that's been crossed.
So I was a kid in 1992. So I didn't really fully realize the extent to which it was, quote, the year of the woman. I didn't realize that there were these quite real effects in which more women were elected to Congress, more women went to college, like more women reported sexual harassment. That's something that I didn't actually that was new to me. I suppose that I should have known that. But that there was a measurable, demonstrable effect was somewhat surprising.
Yeah.
And you can see this already with the Trump stuff. I think like there was one stat that, you know, people calling into a rape and assault hotline, it was up 33%. I know that happened too when the Bill Cosby revelations were out there. So there are, you know, these big national narratives that grip us really do help women work through their own trauma.
So the moment feels different to me. And here's how it feels different. It's for what you just said, Noreen. Like, I feel like when Anita Hill happened, and June, don't you think this? It's like, it was like the gates came down. Like, it was something so new, like talking about this in public, the way women responded to it, the relief that washed over people that such a thing could be discussed in public. And she was talking about a fairly ordinary government workplace, you know, so that this could be happening there. Whereas this moment, you know, I am experiencing it as like we're killing off the kings, you know, like it's like, do you know what I mean? It's like these guys like Roger Ailes, Bill Cosby, Donald Trump, like it feels like they're just the last of a generation. Now, maybe I'm wrong about that because that's not how Twitter is experiencing this. Like Twitter's experiencing this like this is real. This is live. This happens to me every day. But it's almost like the culture is ready for it and can respond instantaneously, which wasn't the case with Anita Hill, where it just kind of took a while for people to like stop gasping the like, holy shit, I can't believe people talking about this in public. Whereas now it's like we're primed to sort of smash these guys down.
Well, you know, we live with the past, you know, with the remnants of the past. I mean, as Dahlia Lithwick had a piece in Slate about that, you know, Anita Hill moment, you know, comparing things to 1992. And, you know, she pointed out that it was, in a sense, the Anita Hill hearings that led to these sexual harassment videos that we have to watch every time, every year, you know, because of requirements at work. You know, so that's now part of our life, you know, the way that domestic violence used to be something that the police didn't always deal with uniformly. Now they're required to do certain things. That changes the way that we all respond to issues. You know, what happens in the past changes the present. So it doesn't surprise me that it doesn't feel quite the same, but it feels like it's of the same sort of level of import.
So what does it change now? So what does this change? If that led to a culture where the language around sexual harassment and the laws around sexual harassment became understood by people, what does this change?
I don't know, but I want to question the whole premise of the road that we're going down.
All right.
I'm not sure this is such a great moment for feminism, right? Like, I think it's great that women are coming forward and talking about their assaults. But let's step back and first of all, most women who were already going to vote for Trump are still voting for him, right? Like, right. So we are having this great moment on our side of the picket fence. But what this actually is a really polarizing moment in America where some people are, you know, doubling down and just saying, well, it's just locker room talk. Men and women are saying that. And then also just bigger picture, okay, we're going to elect our first woman president. And I've seen people on Twitter saying, isn't it amazing? It's like we're literally electing our first woman president using feminism. You know, like this the way that everyone is responding to this is a direct response of feminism. This is actually just like, OK, who do we want as our president? Like a caveman or a woman? I guess we'll go with a woman. Like it's not. I don't think it's a great step forward at all. And when we're watching these debates where Donald Trump is lining up the women who accused Bill Clinton of assault, it becomes this. I just do not think that ultimately this is good for feminism. I don't think that women's assaults have become political pawns in a way that's pretty gross. I think that. Yeah, I don't know. It's almost if you were scripting this as a movie or as a novel, you would say this is unrealistic. The first woman president isn't going to have to go up against this guy. I question the whole premise. Sorry, yeah. Guys.
No, I mean, the fact is true. The fact that even after all of this, it's not that much of a slam dunk. Like you look at the polls, it's not that, you know, yes, I think we are definitely going to have President Clinton. But there's still a whole lot of people who are going to vote for the caveman. But I do think that there that video, just the one, you know, on the Access Hollywood set from 2005, I think even the fact, this sounds so very basic, but the fact that people look at that and say, that is really not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot do this in a public setting, in a workplace setting. That is, it kind of feels ridiculous to be celebrating that we now agree that that is not okay. But at the same time, there's millions of people voting for Trump. I guess I should be a little bit grateful that we agree that that's not okay.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by a pawn, Noreen? That was interesting. You mean that it just becomes like a game you can play in a presidential election?
Yeah, like which candidate is tied to more assaults is like really a thing that's happening. And it becomes, okay, did Melania play this press conference right? Like, first of all, definitely no, because she both excused her husband. She basically excused her husband for the, and then performed the very thing that her husband is accusing Hillary Clinton of having performed when Bill Clinton was accused of. I mean, it's all very complicated. But, yeah, I mean, Oppo researchers are just tracking down any woman who's ever come in the path of Bill Clinton or Donald Trump. It just, there's something very, it's just unseemly. It's distilling the game of politics down to its grossest in just at a pace that's grueling.
Right. And it's like instrumental, like the way we felt about Paula Jones, like she was being used by this giant machine. You get the sense that these women who were harassed are just being used by this giant machine of politics to throw at the other person. So it's not dignified.
Like, Juanita Broderick, like, of course she is not a Clinton supporter, but then she's become part of the Trump apparatus in this way that's so complicated. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just... I just my skin's crawling.
It's, at the same time, it is such a weird aberrational election.
I hope.
But I mean, I can't believe that the next election is going to revolve around a competition between whether vile behavior is beyond the pale or whether, you know, this latest Russian hack reveals anything. Like, it's just so weird and bizarre. This can't possibly be the new normal. Right, Hannah?
Although I do feel bad. I know I totally agree with you, but I do feel bad for Hillary because, as you started to say, one of you said, you know, it's almost like she didn't really win in the end. Like, we're not mm-hmm. talking about the first woman president. Is she ever going to get to know whether she won fairly or she only won because she was running against a caveman? You know, like, is it going to be a clean victory for her? Like, do we get our clean first woman president, or like, do you just get anybody could have won against?
Well, yeah,
them?
I mean, this is who the party that opposes her nominated. This is, you know, this is, it grows out of an ideology, frankly, that they have fertilized. Yeah. So, yeah, I think she wins cleanly. You know, it's no one made them nominate Donald Trump.
Right. There have been some really great episodes of Jacob Weisberg's podcast, Trumpcast, in the last couple of weeks. And there was a really great one with, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting his name, but the GOP, you know, advisor, Mike.
Murphy?
Yes, Mike Murphy. Really great episode where, you know, he talks about just the sort of the depths to which the GOP have sunk by choosing to, you know, to make this guy their candidate.
Well, I'm super interested in the Republican response and the tiered Republican response, right? But people weren't really stepping away until this video came out in which he'd been heard saying this, but then some people still didn't step away. And then, you know, people like Mitt Romney said sort of weird things like, we need to protect our women, essentially, mm-hmm. in this.
It's the whole wives and daughters thing.
Yeah, it just, I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm being unfair to Republicans, but I do think it does come out of a certainly complicated relationship that their party has to the personhood of women. And yes, it's good that people are you know, renouncing Trump, but I don't think that it's a clean break exactly.
I had this awkward relationship with, I mean, this awkward conversation with my daughter the other day. She was like, okay, I get that there's something wrong with Donald Trump and the way he talks about women, but what about Howard Stern? Like, who the hell is Howard Stern?
Mm.
And then I realized, like, I was like, well, I don't know. He was just always on, like in my childhood. Like, yeah. I don't know that it ever, you know, it's just embarrassing that, like, that was just the background chatter of my childhood was Howard Stern. And I suddenly felt embarrassed. Like I didn't, you know, that was just like she would never, like, it wouldn't be normal now to have Howard Stern on the radio and the way he talks and, like, people listening to him. It just wouldn't be normal.
Yeah. How are you explaining this to your kids? I've thought about that. Like, I'm so glad I don't have kids for this election.
We watched the debates together, and I think that it's because of SNL actually helps a lot, because they see, I mean, if Donald Trump were to win, we'd be in trouble. But they do, like, they see him as a ridiculous figure. They just see him as a person who can't control himself and a ridiculous person. And they see, you know, Alec Baldwin making fun of him. So somehow they don't take him seriously. Like, at what level in their heart they understand that, well, this guy's like a presidential candidate. So he is a pretty serious figure in our country, but somehow he's become like a celebrity that the culture makes fun of. I think that's the place that he's filed in their minds more than, you know, he's filed with the other serious political figures in America.
Do your daughter and her friends see this as an empowering moment for women? Like, do they see it as a, like, women coming forward, taking down this man kind of thing? Or have they not thought of
it? Yeah, I mean, the high school kids are really into the Twitter. Not my daughter necessarily, but the high school kids are really into the daughter, like the Twitter moment of people kind of banding together and being confessional and, you know, opposing him. So, yes, I think that's a big thing, and that's good, and it's powerful, and it's good that they have a voice in a place where they can speak it.
Yeah, that makes me think that maybe, you know, there might be an effect in the way that we talked about at the beginning, the Anita Hill effect.
All right. Well, surely there'll be more Trump in a couple of weeks, but not for that much longer. So our next topic is Insecure, the new Issa Rae show. Before we talk about that, let's hear from our sponsor. So for our next topic, we will talk about Insecure, a new HBO comedy starring Issa Rae, who's the creator of the Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl series. In it, she plays Issa, an LA girl with a boyfriend she's kind of tepid about, a best friend who has even more dating trouble than she does. And the white people are kind of comic relief, right, in her office, with one exception. That's fair to say that. They're just like played for laughs,
I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Anyway, we're going to discuss the show today with Aisha Harris, who is Slate culture writer and host of the new Slate podcast, Represent. Hi, Aisha.
Hello.
Hello. here's my question about Issa Rae. She's like, she's awkward, but also totally charismatic and beautiful. Do you know what I mean? Like, she's not actually awkward.
I think maybe that's why she changed it from awkward to insecure when she went to HBO. She was like, I'm not actually awkward. I'm just insecure.
Well, I grew out of my awkwardness. Yeah.
I mean, I feel like she's still very, she finds herself in a lot of awkward situations on the show, despite being charismatic and beautiful. So I feel like awkward still fits.
Yeah.
I think anybody who is regularly taped giving yourself pep talks in the mirror in some way is awkward.
I used to keep a journal to vent. Now I just write raps.
Go, shawty. It's my birthday, but no one cares because I'm not having a party because I'm feeling sorry for myself.
And there's like, she like raps the pep talks. Maybe that's like super awkward. Who wants to describe, like, I guess the central thread of the show is her friendship with Molly. Is that fair?
Yeah.
And both of their relationship problems, I guess, is the other key theme.
Yeah, it seems like a show that's just about relationships, both between other women and also through the love interest, male love interest in their lives.
Right. And work relationships, too.
True.
Both of their works, like, have plot lines on the show.
So does it feel to you like a particularly, like, black dating show, or does it feel to you just like a painful dating show? Like, that's something I'm thinking about when I'm watching. Is it like, are these problems like, are they kind of sociology it in the first episode? You know, like, they give that speech, this sort of, you know, a single college educated African American. Is that a fake speech or a real speech that someone in her office gives her? Is that like a speech in her imagination or a speech she actually hears?
Imagination, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That's not like a real speech. So that's kind of how it kicks it off. But I feel like it kind of leaves that theme after a while. Like, it's just about the pains of dating for anybody in LA.
Well, but then you've got it in the back of your head. I think there are moments when it pops to the forefront. Like, I think particularly with Molly's character. So Molly is not in a relationship. Basically, she's more actively dating. And she has very strict requirements about what she wants in a guy. And I don't know how spoilery this is, but she goes out with a guy she really likes, but he doesn't have a college degree. So she ends it. And she goes on this website called The League, which is like for people who've gone to elite colleges.
Now, but Molly is such a particular character. Like, they're always playing with this idea that Molly is kind of crazy, you know, yeah. Like Molly's not crazy, but like her demands, like she's so controlled. And yet somehow in her control, she gives off an air of desperation, you know, because she needs to know so much. And it just translates as kind of excessive neediness.
But
you're all like, yeah,
that's right. For sure. Well, Molly occupies a really, she's the character on the show who code switches the most. You sort of get the sense that Issa is basically from an upper middle class background. And she said as much in the first episode that all the white people in her office think she's from the hood. And she's like, no, I'm not. Whereas Molly, I think, self-describes as a quote-unquote hood rat. She's this high-powered corporate lawyer, and she can act. She can sort of blend in different environments. But part of that, I mean, you see where the control comes in. If she's always thinking about what is her, you know, how is she interacting with her environment, she's not always just like letting it flow.
So did it feel to you like super fresh, like a different voice? I've never seen people talk this way about dating. I've never heard people like just describe these particular situations. Like, Aisha, as a person who consumes like insane amounts of culture, like, did it just feel to you like I haven't heard this kind of thing before?
Well, I hate to phrase it this way, but as a Black woman, it was very familiar, but in a good way. Like, I haven't seen these sort of conversations on TV in a long time. I've read a lot of pieces about this show, and a lot of Black women have written about how it reminds them of other shows that we haven't seen in forever, like Girlfriends, the great show from the early 2000s that was created by Mara Brock Akil. Go back even further to Living Single.
I was just about to cite my old favorite Thursday night show.
I love Living Single. So you have those shows, and those have very frank talk about relationships. But because we're now, you know, 16 years after Girlfriends debuted and more than 20 years since Living Single started, it feels fresh because we're now talking, we're including online dating. And we also have a new sort of different perspective where it's Black people culturally have, evolved is not the right word, but I feel like there are so many even more facets that are now being seen on television, whether you're looking at Queen Sugar or Atlanta. And so this is just another sort of aspect of that. And so, yes, it feels fresh, but at the same time, it feels familiar in a comforting way.
Mm-hmm. I loved Issa Rae gave an interview in which she was like, I just wanted to show Black people like being basic, I think was the phrase that she used.
Yeah.
And I found this show pretty familiar as just someone who listens to my friends talk about dating. You know, I'm not Black, but like I think that a lot of what she's talking about is pretty universal. You know, her boyfriend who is a really good guy, but she's not that into, and they're pushing 30, and what are they going to do? Like, all of it felt, again, that part didn't necessarily feel specific to race for me. And I'm wondering if you could highlight some things that you felt like, okay, this conversation wouldn't have happened among white women.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if we can go as far as the fourth episode, because I think they've only aired the first two episodes
That's right.
But anyway, in the fourth episode, I can talk about it without getting too far into it, because you actually already mentioned like the one of the guys that she's dating who she really hits it off with. It turns out he doesn't have a college degree. So there's first of all, I have to check this, but I wonder if this is the first like TV show or film that has ever actually depicted a real sorority, black sorority, because it's
yeah,
like
that was cool.
Because Black sororities and fraternities are very, very protective of their legacies, and on every show you can think of, whether it's A Different World, the movie Dear White People, they all feature, fake fraternities and sororities, so they don't piss off like the real life deltas and AFIAs. But they go to a like college alumni thing, and you see like they do the sign, the AKA sign, and of course Molly's an AKA. Like it just makes so much sense, because I don't want to go into it, but she's very much the AKA type.
No, go into it. What is this, like type A?
Yeah,
cool girl.
AKAs are, they're self-described, if I remember correctly, and I'm going to get some hate because I was never in a sorority or fraternity, and Verilyn is probably laughing at me right now. But AKAs are often self-described as, like, the pretty ones, the quote-unquote pretty ones. They tend to be... That's as far as I'll go. Those conversations and that sort of just like the signal, the hand gesture that they make is very specific to Black people.
The other time that a Black sorority has been depicted in a piece of mainstream pop culture, in Suburgatory, Dallas Reese, who is a white woman, was shown as being a member of a Black sorority. And it was, which of course is kind of ridiculous.
Do you know if it was a real one, or was it like a fictionalized one?
I don't know, but they, you know, she, it, they, there was a at least one episode when she was visiting her sorors, and it was very peculiar, and not terribly realistic. But the other thing about this show that is really striking to me is that we hear the N-word all the time.
Same with Atlanta too. It's right, a lot.
Yeah, and in a sort of loving way. You know, it's you know, where another show might say the word brother, they use the N-word. But they don't talk about it. You know, they don't ever refer to, oh, my goodness, I just said the N-word. You know, like, it's the attempt is to show this is just part of our life. This is just how we talk. And that does feel different. That makes it different from, you know, girls, for example.
Let's hope. I don't know what's coming on this season. I liked, exactly. Willa Paskin had a review on Slate that I liked in which she sort of compared it to Sex and the City and said that actually, you know, in the years since Sex and the City, there hasn't really been a show that's taken dating as seriously as that show did, and that this... that one thing that she enjoyed about this was how much space it gave to the conversation. And, like, you know, it allowed Molly to have reactions like her coworker gets engaged and she starts weeping. And, you know, is that hopelessly old fashioned or is it really real or is it both? You know, and specifically her coworker who's Asian gets engaged to a Black man, which I think was particularly tough for her. So I like that, too.
I also appreciate the fact that to sort of counterbalance, because I actually felt that Molly's story was sort of a little too familiar and repetitive, and the idea that an educated black woman has a hard time getting a man. But I like the fact that it's balanced by Issa's character, mm-hmm. who's trying to get rid of her man. And it's like, how often do you see that where it's like, it's not even just that she's pining for this other dude who she like never hooked up with, but like always fantasized about it. So there's that sort of B subplot. But in the forefront, she's trying, like, how do I end this relationship that's just gotten too comfortable and too like isn't going anywhere? Mm-hmm. And I really liked that aspect.
I love that relationship. I often talk about how, to me, like, the sign of a really good show is when it brings up a feeling in me that I recognize from my own life. And I totally recognized Issa's feelings of her relationship with Lawrence is just kind of stuck. Mm-hmm. And it's not awful by any means. And he's not a bad guy. And they're not fighting every night. But at the same time, it doesn't feel like it's going anywhere. And, you know, I remember I was like sent back to a similar time in my life when I was like, I just need to end this, but should I? Because it's really not awful. And that the fact that a show can just remind you of something from your own life, something very physical that it's very hard to tap into, that's a really great sign of, you know, quality art, I think.
My favorite character is the bank teller. I think she's the bank. The one who flirts with Lawrence.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the one who carries Tabasco sauce in her bag, who's always flirting with him. She's awesome.
She's funny.
And she quotes Beyonce.
The show's funny. I feel like we haven't covered that, but it is, it's sociologically interesting, but it's also just funny, amusing television.
Do you think the guys are just like a little too good looking? Like the guys are always taking off their shirts and you're like, whoa.
I thought that was what LA was
like. One of them.
that's television. Have you ever watched a CW show? Like whenever I see actual men, I'm like, oh my God, what's happened to your body? And then I realize, oh, it's just because the only guys I see are on the CW. That's not normal.
Good for her. She got to cast who she wanted to cast. She gave herself like two hot men who were very interested in her. I think it's great.
You just like Lawrence because he's a Hoya.
It's true. He went to my alma mater on the show.
My favorite character is the blood who never says the letter C.
Yes, yes. He's like his neighbor, right? Their neighbor in the apartment complex.
Yeah. Oh, that was amazing.
Okay, I stand very corrected. This isn't, I mean, there are like definitely details that are extremely specific to Black life.
But I think it says something that you don't initially notice it. It's not like, it's not beating you over the head with it. It just creeps in very naturally. And I think that's the strength, like one of the strengths of the show is that it's so detailed in its characters. Even Lawrence, who sort of starts off as a sort of flat character in the first couple episodes, we slowly start to see his side of things. And I just think it's really good characterization. Mm-hmm. And I think that is contributing, like that helps with the fact that you can't really tell that it's so, I mean, you can, but you don't have to notice it, that it's super Black, quote unquote.
Is it very different? I was not a watcher of her web series. How different is it from her web series?
There's a lot that comes through. Like the rapping is very much a part of the web series.
Do you guys like the rapping?
I do. I find it charming, and that is the awkward part of her, right?
And the insecure part.
Yeah. I think it grew on me. The first episode, I was like, ooh, this is going to make me tense every time it happens. And then a few episodes in, I was like, all right, like this is super important to her character, and I get it.
Right. Like you'll see in the later episodes that it becomes a sort of a plot point, too. So it makes sense. And also just the fact of her talking to herself in the mirror is also very much really like a lot of stuff is a holdover from the series, including the sort of imaginative, what you mentioned earlier of her like hearing voices and talking to herself and then having the sort of like a white character says something to her and then you hear her thoughts in voiceover. Right. Yeah, all of that is taken directly from the show. But this is a more polished, obviously, because it's HBO, but it's also not too polished either.
Right, yeah.
I love the rap. I feel like the rapping expresses everything about her. It's like her awkwardness, but then there's also like an anger translator moment. And then as Aisha says, like it becomes like a big thing later on.
And part of her character's big arc is like she's not sure she's doing something meaningful with her life. She had this creative past and it's like a callback to that. I think it's well done.
All right. So what about that moment without spoiling? There's a moment where a new summer associate comes and this new summer associate is very successful. She's like, editor of the Law Review, but she doesn't code switch. Like she's louder than everybody else in the office. And Molly has to figure out how to handle her. What did you guys think of that dynamic?
I loved it. I thought it was really smart. And yeah, I don't want to spoil it too much, because I think the way that the two of them interact and confront Molly's feelings about the fact that she doesn't code switch is very interesting. But that also just felt really true to life to me. And I think it speaks to more generally the sort of Black experience of being in a mostly white environment and then having another Black person show up. And you want to, there's a feeling of you want to help them, especially if you've been there longer. But then what if they don't want to play by your rules? And you know, I just felt that dynamic was something that was something that felt very new. And I can't even think of, maybe I'm missing, it's been a while since I've watched both Living Single and Girlfriend. So maybe there were moments like this in the show. There probably were. But that just felt, it's a tale as old as time. It'll never not feel relevant, probably.
But it did play out in a kind of unexpected way. Like at first, you couldn't tell if it was generational because the other girl was younger. Like you weren't sure exactly who was right and who was wrong and how exactly it was going to play out. Like I feel like the way it ultimately got resolved was pretty unexpected.
Yeah. I mean, she didn't seem that much younger. Like law, so like first years could easily be, you know, late 20s. And I think Molly's supposed to be 30.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it could be generational. I hadn't even thought of it in that way.
Well, and the way that Molly handles it is of a piece with her character. She's fully in control the whole time, even in a moment when she's like sort of back on her heels.
Yes. I would also recommend watching the first season of Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl. The second season, it gets a little, it's not as well put together, I think. And it feels a little scattershot. But first season is quality.
I also just want to mention the actress who plays Molly's name, who I've never seen her before, and I thought she was really great. Her name is Yvonne Orji, and she and Issa Rae have really good chemistry as friends. It's very a believable relationship.
Yeah. All right. So we all recommend Insecure, right? Everybody should go watch Insecure. We loved it. All right. Well, Aisha, thank you so much for coming on to talk to us today. You should all go listen to Aisha's podcast, Represent.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
So our next segment, we're going to talk about Future Sex, a new book by Emily Witt. But before we do that, let's hear from our sponsor. All right. So for our next topic, we are going to talk about Future Sex, a new book by Emily Witt, which is about, I guess it's about different possibilities, the world of sex we're heading towards, or maybe the world of sex we live in now, where she explores internet dating, orgasmic meditation, porn, polyamory, and various subcultures. We have Emily here with us today. She's written for The New Yorker and N Plus One. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
So here's my first question. I feel like you're trying to figure something out in this book. Like, this book has a strong sense of, like, I'm trying to figure out something for myself. I'm trying to figure out something about the world. Like, what's the question that animated you, like, that started this whole search for you? What were you trying to figure out?
Yeah, I think initially the question was just, you know, how to live a fulfilled, connected life when you're a single person and your life doesn't conform to a traditional narrative of romantic love for whatever reason you're not in love at a moment. And that question is really what to do with your sexual freedom and how to feel connected, happy, stable, and emotionally fulfilled.
Emily, I'm curious, at different parts of the book, it felt like your presence varied. You know, at some parts, especially at the beginning, it wasn't all about you. That makes it, that misrepresents the book. But you were very much, you know, it was your quest was the animating, you know, was what moved the narrative. And then in other parts, it felt like you were more of a observer. Was that a tension for you as you were writing the book? Was that something that you were very conscious of manipulating?
I wouldn't say I was conscious. It was more that I thought when I set out I was going to write a very third-person journalistic reported book about a kind of recent cultural history of sexuality post-internet. And then as I went on, it became much more personal. My editors found the personal writing more compelling in some ways. So there's the fact that it's kind of a mix between reportage and memoir. The memoir part actually came in later.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Well, we should explain a little bit the specifics of what you saw, right? Because it really runs the gamut. So you saw orgasmic meditation a lot of this book is in San Francisco, right? So there's orgasmic meditation, which was a whole thing. Mm-hmm. There was, you tracked pretty closely a polyamorous circle in San Francisco, mostly tech workers. You went to Burning Man. You watched a pretty crazy porn get filmed. What else?
Webcamming.
Webcamming. Oh, yeah.
That was super interesting.
People who consider themselves internet sexual. So it really ran the gamut of, I would say, experiences that are towards the fringe, right? And I guess that's what you mean by future sex.
Yeah, I mean a few things by future sex. One was just my future. Another was, you know, I've said this, I feel that there's a machine bias in futurism, and people think of futuristic ideology as having to do with technology or virtual reality or teledildonics, and there's less ideation about how the future of the family will change, less kind of utopian thinking or speculative thinking. Somehow putting that thinking in the realm of the futuristic makes it maybe more exciting and more,
It's funny that you say that because the chapter that I probably found most unsettling, I suppose, is the internet sexual chapter, the people who were on the service Chatterbait. Is that the name of it? Chatterbait? Mm-hmm. And I guess what I found unsettling about it was the loneliness that you saw portrayed in there. It's people who just sort of, well, you can explain it much better than I can.
Yeah, sure. I spent some time on a website called Chatterbait the website is not that important. Chatterbait is spelled like masturbate, so it has that in it. And the people on this website, there's a kind of community of people that perform for viewers in a kind of traditional pornographic voyeuristic dynamic. And then there's people that go on to connect and have community and have what could be called internet sex with each other. So I spoke with women mostly, a range of women. I don't know that they were lonely. I mean, they were, yeah.
Well, you describe one woman who really kind of puts her whole life on there. Like, it's not just sort of performing sexually for people. It's like she keeps the camera on when she's, I don't know, doing the dishes and stuff like that. And that, I guess, is part of the titillation, part of the, like, this is just, you know, glimpsing an ordinary girl's life. But the rest of her life, this seemed to be a big part of her life was performing it for strangers, right?
Mm-hmm.
For me, an interesting part, I really loved that chapter. And one of the things that was interesting to me was the sort of potential change in the way people make money. I mean, I think that was a chapter where you particularly cited the economic dimension of it, that many of the people who webcam in this way, essentially, it's almost like the equivalent of like work from home, you know, those weird old flyers that you used to see, you know, in poor neighborhoods. Like, this is something that you can do without too much investment. It's a way to make money, probably not very much. But, you know, it's almost like it's a DIY kind of enterprise. And maybe that is kind of a future of employment.
Yeah, I think like those work from home flyers, it's not a good living. Right. But one thing that kept coming up. Many of the people I interviewed were taking care of a sick person at home. And that was so interesting to me, the way, you know, how your possibilities for earning income get limited when you have to do these life, you have to take care of these challenges in life. Right. And it kept coming up.
That was depressing to me. I mean, you didn't elaborate on it. I mean, you just sort of put it as a fact out mm-hmm. there. But I've been thinking about that a lot, like, because mm-hmm. it's a good thing and a terrible thing, mm-hmm. you know, like many of the things that you describe. Like, it's probably if you are in the life of taking care of a sick person, like you know, it's good to have this other outlet. It's you feel probably just completely invisible. So it's good to find a way to make yourself visible. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know how to feel about the fact that that was the route to making yourself visible. You know, yeah. Like, when did it become exploitative?
And the gender dynamics of it, too. That was, again, the chapter where you talked about how women, you know, have various different sorts of things that they can do, but it's essentially about revealing yourself. Whereas for the men, you have a great line. It was amazing the diversity of what men wanted performed for them and how little they offered to others. I mean, you show them just sort of sitting in chairs, essentially moving their hands. Mm-hmm. not a great deal of variety in their presentation.
Yeah.
Can you talk? I love the orgasmic meditation people, and I also loved your relationship with the orgasmic meditation people, which was so reluctant, you know, like you understood what was interesting about what they were saying, and yet they irritated you. Can you just talk about who they are and sort of what they taught you?
Sure. They're a group of people that practice something called orgasmic meditation. It's kind of a tantric sex practice where the man strokes the woman, or it doesn't have to be a man, a stroker strokes a woman's clitoris for 15 minutes in a very, and she doesn't have to reciprocate. It's a very contained thing.
With a timer for 15 minutes, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's not supposed to lead to intercourse or anything like that. It's just a contained meditative practice that they describe like yoga or meditation. You do it every day and you get more wisdom incrementally over time. When I went in there for the first time, you know, I had no idea what to expect. I'd read about it in the New York Times and I was just curious, but I went in, you know, just saying at every opportunity that I was a journalist, just, you know, I'm a reporter. And, you know, mostly because, as I say in the beginning of the book, journalism for me was an alibi to explore some of the stuff that I just wouldn't have let myself explore on my own. I went in and I was also just skeptical. They use a lot of language from the human potential movement, which, you know, began with things like EST and Landmark Forum, and they'd all been to all of those things. They'd all been to a lot of Esalen workshops and whatnot. So I was just a little skeptical of that thinking, and some people have accused them of being a cult. But then, I did it. I went to the workshops and I tried the practice myself, and I left, and months passed, and I just kept thinking about it. And ultimately, I'm really grateful that I did that. And I think a lot of people who tried it feel the same way. I don't know. There was just an article in Elle by someone who had a similar experience, I think.
The thing that I took from it is just this idea of, you wrote about this, but sexual energy as distinct from kind of social dynamics, male-female dynamics, as distinct from romance or dating. That's just kind of an interesting idea, like that there is such a just a thing called sexual energy that you can harness or put out there in the world, but that has nothing to do with,
relationships,
people,
or intimacy.
Relationships, right. Mm-hmm. It's like a different way of thinking of sex decoupled from relationships that seems positive.
Yeah.
One of the things that was striking both about the orgasmic meditation and also the BDSM porn taping that you went to was the role of talking. I agree with Hannah that there's both this very physical, separated from feelings dimension, but then both of those practices, or both of the sort of structure of those things, require the person to almost give a testimony. You know, you talk in the orgasmic meditation, part of the practice is describing the vulva before the stroking begins. And is there a post after the mm-hmm. after the phone, after the alarm?
Yeah, you share. They call them frames. They have all this language, but yeah you share a specific moment where you felt something.
Yeah. So there's a lot of talking too. Obviously, as a word person, do you think you would do that just sort of, screamed out to you, or am I right in thinking that this whole, there's almost like a, it seems to be almost, you use that word alibi as far as your own role, but it almost seems like the words are an alibi for, oh my God, we just had sex in front of all these people, or we had a sexual moment. Now if we talk about it, that makes it more okay.
Yeah, I mean, that was the difference between these communities, many of these communities that I was visiting, and my own group of friends in my own social circle. Is I may be a word person, but I did not, if you had asked me at the beginning when I started working on this book, how would I describe who I am sexually and what I want? And I just hadn't put that into language before. And my friends didn't either. We avoided classifying ourselves according to a certain lifestyle. Or it felt sort of cheesy or something to do this earnest process of self-declaration that on the West Coast I found very prevalent.
I have to say, like, the Q&A with Penny. So Penny is a woman who is called in and volunteers to do, what's it called? It's like public, it's not public.
It's called public, it's like disgrace.
Public disgrace. So it's a kind of elaborate theater of sexual public disgrace that she volunteers for.
And then afterward. Huh? And is paid for.
Yeah, she's a porn star.
And is paid for.
Penny Packs.
Yeah, she's a porn star. Yeah. And you can describe it, but what I loved the Q&A with her, and I can't explain why. I just like the contrast between what she'd just been through, which seemed kind of sublime and profound and so intense, and the Q&A, which was like, that was awesome. I felt so awesome. Like, and you reprinted the Q&A. It was really great. So, Emily, do you feel like after going through all this, you think differently, or you'll live differently than before you started this?
Yeah, it changed everything for me this process of inquiry. I feel, first, I was just kind of embarrassed and insecure before, and just being around a bunch of naked people having sex with each other turned out to be really good for me. And I really went in the book, I go through and really examine all of the mythologies by which I was living my life. And, you know, discarding some of them, keeping some of them was helpful to me. You know, I no longer let the culture define commitment for me, I would say. For me, it's not that I would declare myself a priori non-monogamous or something. I'm not sure what that means, but it's more that when I enter into relationships with people now, we discuss what the terms of our commitment to each other will be. And I like that. It makes me feel, I don't know, I just feel like I'm more free somehow.
Well, thank you, Emily, so much for joining us. You should all check out the book Future Sex. It is out and it is fabulous.
Thank you.
All right, let's do recommendations. But before we do that, let's hear from our final sponsor. All right, let's move on to our recommendations. June, why don't you go first?
Well, I could be a complete nerd, or I could be awful and recommend all these TV shows I saw when I was in Britain, but that would be cruel. So I will instead recommend the season 3 of Halt and Catch Fire, which ended last week and was really good. It's very rare that a show improves with every season, but I think that's been true of Halt and Catch Fire. So it's an AMC series that in the first season was kind of about the creation of the personal computer. I can't really remember what happened in the second season, but the third season was about really the birth of the internet. And I love how the characters have kind of evolved. There are sometimes surprising turns that don't feel like, oh, they just added a completely new dimension to that character. It's more feels that the character has been rounded out. So I highly recommend Halt and Catch Fire on AMC.
Excellent. We're all TV. We're all TV this week because I'm going to recommend High Maintenance, which I love. I loved it as a web series. I love it as a TV show. It's basically the web series sort of stretched out and a little longer, but it still has that same tension. For anyone who hasn't watched it, it's about like a pot dealer, and people call him and he delivers to their house. But then you're kind of following the mini dramas in the apartments or the houses. It's mostly apartments because he's delivering in New York that he's delivering to. And so they basically, like, you know, 10,000 New York stories as told through the wanderings of the dealer. And he's kind of a muted personality. Mm-hmm. He's the sort of traveling narrator and allows these stories to take root. But I love them, and they're all really unusual.
And they're not super stonery. Mm. I feel like that could turn some people off. I was trying to get my mom to watch, and it's not stonery. It's just like a beautifully painted portrait, like a short story, basically.
Yeah, they're not stonery at all. It could be like a teenage. I mean, it's not like only stoners smoke pot anymore, right? It could be absolutely anyone. It's like middle-aged couples, you know, teenage girls. It's like every kind of person washes through that show.
Right.
All right, Noreen, what do you got?
I've been reading a book that I just find to be a total delight. It's called The Old Man and Me by Elaine Dundy. And I think probably before on the show I've recommended The Dud Avocado, which is where you should start if you have not yet read any Elaine Dundy. But this one is, she's a very funny writer. She was married to Kenneth Tynan, the like famous critic, and she writes I don't know how to best describe her style, but it's tongue in cheek. And this character is an American girl who goes abroad in the classic fashion. She goes to England. And the plot twist is that she begins pursuing an old man who, it turns out, married her father's widow, who had gotten the fortune that this young woman should have gotten. So she is trying to get the fortune back. And it's a lot of sort of wry American poking fun at the super posh, stuck-up Brits. There's this great set piece in a sort of country house that's if you stuck an American raised on television in the middle of a Jane Austen novel, this is what you would get. It was written in the early 60s. Anyway, it's very fun. It's lighthearted. The Old Man and Me by Elaine Dundy.
Sounds great. Well, that's all we got for this week. Thank you to our producer, Vera Lynn Williams. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of Panoply. And our fabulous intern, Daniel Schrader. The XX GabFest is part of the Panoply Network. You can check out the entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page to find out more about this show and our recommendations at slate.com/XX. Or our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, to comment, give us suggestions for what we should talk about next time, critique, send love, whatever you want. Or you can email us, XXGabFest@slate.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave comments so other people can find out about our show. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you in 2 weeks.
Sorry, I ain't sorry. I ain't sorry.